It's a beautiful day and a fine time for healing. Podcast host Randy Fine, a narcissistic abuse expert and the author of the groundbreaking book Close Encounters of the Worst Kind and the captivating memoir Cliff Edge Road, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being are all that matter. So put your feet up, relax, and enjoy today's show.
Good morning.
And now, here's Randy.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your show host, Randy Fine. So today we are going to talk about the fears that are being brought on by the pandemic. And I know it's happening to so many of us as the nation struggles to get control of the COVID-19 outbreak. Millions of us are experiencing what today's special guests, Daryl and Sarah Van Togeren, call existential suffering. You know, I've actually had people say to me, I'm having an existential crisis. Daryl and Sarah, authors of the book The Courage to Suffer, are experts in treating this form of psychological trauma, trauma that occurs when people are hit with a crisis so severe that they can no longer depend on the ideas, beliefs, and expectations that previously guided their lives. It is a period of intense inner turmoil in which people question the very meaning of their existence. Daryl Van Togeren, PhD, is an associate professor of psychology at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. He is a social psychologist and has published over 150 scholarly articles and chapters on topics such as meaning in life, religion, virtues, relationships, and well-being. And he is currently an associate editor for the Journal of Positive Psychology and consulting editor for two other publications. Sarah Showalter Van Togeren, LCSW, is a licensed clinical social worker in the states of Michigan and Virginia. She has more than 12 years of clinical social work experience in settings such as private practice, foster care, inpatient hospitals, outpatient medical clinics, inter-partner violence shelters, and behavioral health. Sarah specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness, existential psychotherapy, and more. I want to hear what they have to say, and I know that you do, so we're going to get started. Good morning, Daryl. Good morning, Sarah, and welcome to A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you. We're excited to have our conversation today.
Yeah, we're going to have a great conversation. So why is this, why are we having existential fears, pandemic? Why are we all sort of worrying about where we're going?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, I think things like this, this pandemic that we're all experiencing right now, it kind of unearths these existential realities that every human faces. And so a lot of times when these realities are unexamined, we're very fearful of them. And so just briefly, I'll kind of explain these various existential realities and, you know, why this pandemic might be bringing them up. So one of the first existential realities is the idea of groundlessness. So the idea of groundlessness is we're not in control of our life and the things that happen, but we still have to make a decision in the midst of it. So we still have the freedom to choose, and that's a weighty responsibility. And so for this pandemic, it's really unearthed this reality that control is an illusion. We can't control things. Oftentimes things just happen to us. You know, the second existential concern is isolation, and this is the reality that we each have our own experiences, and we can't really know what the other person is going through. And pandemic has physically, socially isolated us from one another, and it's just brought this reality to the forefront of our mind. The third existential reality is that we all need to navigate our own identity. We need to tell ourselves a compelling story of who we are. And for many of us, this pandemic has shifted our professional identity. Maybe we lost a job or reduced hours, or maybe we're disconnected from people that brought us a sense of who we are. And then the fourth reality, the one that no one really likes to talk about, is the realization that one day we're all going to die. And this pandemic has brought death into the forefront of all of our awareness. And so really this pandemic is a pulling back of the curtain of all of these existential realities. And when we don't have sufficient answers to these questions, it really strains our sense of meaning in life. And we start questioning our purpose and whether or not we're significant and how we make sense of the world.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a very heavy load for all of us to be experiencing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And it feels like it comes from all these different angles and in places that people might not even have previously been aware.
Well, and what we are trying to say, too, is that in this, you know, these fears that we have of groundlessness, isolation, identity, death, those things have always existed. But what happens is for so many people right now, it's triggering all of them simultaneously. And if you think about the times that you've experienced those in the past, whether it's through past trauma or past experiences of those things, it's triggering that as well. So not only for people that have experienced or maybe even know those fears quite intimately, they're being re-triggered, re-traumatized by the feeling that their body, their mind, they, who they are might be experiencing right now.
So you talk about catastrophizing, personalizing, emotional reasoning. And can you explain, because I want actually, let's take a step back and explain where you came from, your personal experience that brought you to really understand existential fears and how to get over them or resolve them. So can you talk a little bit about your personal situation?
Yeah, so part of our story is which, you know, we were both professionals. Daryl was a graduate student at the time, getting his PhD in social psychology. I was just graduated from my MSW program, and we were living in Virginia, and I was working at the time with children and families who had complex medical needs. And so we were really in a sort of professional space, and Daryl was studying not only this theory called terror management theory, which is really fascinating and totally worth a Google search on that one, but then also meaning in life and big questions. And then I was working with people who were suffering, who there was no way out, there was no solution. These were chronic, long-term medical conditions like muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis. And I was realizing what I was doing in what I was taught in school, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is what you were talking about, that idea of catastrophe, like we have these thinking disorders or thinking errors, and that's what leads to a lot of the crisis. And what I was finding is a lot of my clients are very crystal clear. They were not thinking and not having thought disorders, such as their child will die. Like, that's a very crystal clear reality. And so I was realizing that my interventions weren't being as successful as I would have liked. And so I was just very personally curious about existential psychology. So I started reading in that. And then during that time, Daryl and I experienced quite a significant loss, with the loss of his brother.
Right. So it was in my fourth year of my graduate program. My brother had to have a heart surgery that was a follow-up to an emergency surgery he had had on his heart 7 years prior. And he unexpectedly did not survive. And so he passed away, leaving his wife and three children under the age of six. So his three kids were 5, 3, and 9 months. And that really shattered a lot of the assumptions that I had held about the world, the ways that I had kind of made sense of things, the view that I had of God. And so from both a professional perspective and then also personal perspective, we realized that a lot of the approaches that people have offered to helping people who are suffering were just falling short.
Yeah, so this work is born out of that. It's born out of our personal experience. It's born out of our professional experience. We were just finding that there was a giant hole, and then when we were seeking support, seeking therapy, it took multiple times, multiple therapists to try to find someone that didn't, weren't challenging. Well, can you think differently about the tragic loss of your brother? And it's like, you know, sometimes it's just tragic. And I think it was hard to have people that were willing to sit with us in it. And so, like, yeah, so this book was born out of that.
And also you had an issue with infertility when you had it in your mind that you were going to have a family. And that was, then you were,
yeah,
that, you were hit with that as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. So part of, you know, the continued story of that is, you know, when Daryl, actually right before Daryl's brother passed away, we were starting to have a family, starting to try to get pregnant. And because of the nature of Tim's illness, it's a genetic condition. There's an underlying genetic component to that. And so we were told at the time to just put pause on trying to start a family until they could wait till the doctors could help us figure out what was really going on. And so later on, after many years of lack of doctor's appointments, we sort of got a tentative green light, and we decided, you know what, the risks are worth it, so let's try to start having a family. And after many years of trying, we were eventually realized that we were not able to have children, biological children. And so, you know, it was one loss upon another that compounded. And I think that was the thing, again, this work is sort of born out of, is this reality that we can't change some things, even though we wish we would and wish we could. But it's sort of this reality of acceptance of these fears, acceptance of these situations that ultimately can help us come to terms with some of these things and become more comfortable with living them. You know, I want to be honest, it's not easy. I don't think it's, you know, I don't want to sell it like it's easy.
Many people
probably listening know that it's not easy.
Right. It's not easy. And you say that many clinical approaches view suffering as a problem to be fixed, and then once the symptoms subside, disregard the effect of the event itself. There is no fixing death, infertility, loss of a dream, or permanent shift of one's identity. This is so very true. This is really where a lot of therapy falls short in these situations. And you also say that you challenged every cognitive distortion you had, that, you know, you catastrophize that your life is over, you personalize that it's all your fault, you reasoned emotionally that you're inadequate, and you were still left with the fact that you would not be parents and that Daryl's genetic future was unknown. So, so you're suffering was not a set of irrational thoughts that needed to be corrected. So what was it?
Right.
If it couldn't be corrected, what were your thoughts?
Well, first we tried to correct them. Let's just say that with many years spent trying to say, okay, if I think about it, if I try differently, I think therapy has let people down is this idea that if you just think about it correctly, then you'll be released of anxiety. Or if you just have this natural herb or this idea of, you know, natural oils, then you'll reduce your stress and you'll be fine. And yes, that's a component of it, but that, in my opinion, that's not healing. Healing isn't the absence of symptoms, right? Like, I think that the thing is, I would love to stress to every therapist, every person listening to, is that, you know, just like if you were to have cancer, when the cancer is gone and you're no longer, you know, when all the tests come back negative, which is the good thing, which is the thing you hope and pray, you're still left by the jolt of what you experienced when you did have cancer. I work with this with a lot of my clients. They've had severe anxiety at times. And just when we get the symptoms down and you're able to say, oh, the anxiety's gone, you know, you found your oil, you found your coping skills, all these things, that's wonderful. And that's where a lot of the therapy stuff. But in my work, that's actually where the good work begins. Because you can start to look at the deep way in which that anxiety or that bout with those symptoms actually changed you and clarified a few things. So many therapists let clients go at that time. And, of course, many clients want to go. They're like, they want to move on. And that's fine. That's their own prerogative. But I think what we're sort of saying in our book is that's the time where the deep work can happen. And it's hard work.
So you say in your book that, and this is absolutely true, I think we all know it, suffering is an inherent part of life that must be engaged. And that, how do we begin to accept that when the suffering is so overwhelming that we can't even see anything positive?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and that's the incredibly challenging part of this. And I think you're really hitting this is such an important feature, and that is that acceptance is so powerful. And I want to acknowledge that suffering is an inherent part of life, but it's also true that while we all suffer, suffering does fall a little bit more disproportionately on some than others. And some people are going to feel it more, and their reality is going to be more encompassed by their suffering. And it is a struggle, and I would never want to have anyone try to just rush through to acceptance. I'd never want to invalidate somebody's pain by moving them through more quickly than possible. You know, and part of that, part of the work is trying to determine what is uncomfortable and what is unbearable. And sometimes you have to just start slowly with trying to accept in small, uncomfortable ways. And when the pain becomes too unbearable, take a break. But moving toward acceptance, understanding the reality of the situation is incredibly painful. But what we hope is that it'll lead to a point in which people can really start questioning some of the assumptions that they held about the world that just aren't fitting anymore. So for me, and I didn't even know that I had these. I thought that I had thought these through. I kind of thought that the world was fair and good things happen to good people. And
maybe you didn't think these explicitly. Like maybe if someone asked you that, you would have.
I would have denied it flatly, right? But somewhere in the deep recesses of my mind, at least on an implicit level, I was holding these assumptions because when this thing happened to my brother, I thought, well, gosh, what did he do to deserve this? What did his family do to deserve this? And once we accept what is, and that is so painful and that is so hard.
Because we want to be honest, that just because you accept suffering doesn't mean that suffering suddenly stops. Sometimes that's when it hits you the hardest. It's like, well, crap, this is terrible, and I didn't want this. And that's what you're saying, right?
Right. And once you see it fully for what it is, then you can start having the autonomy to question the beliefs that we're holding up and to start deconstructing and reconstructing those beliefs in a way that are a little bit more authentic to your experience. So a belief that I needed to jettison, and it was painful to do, was this idea that things happen for a reason and that good things happen to good people. And that's a painful thing to let go, because apparently that had been very deep inside my psyche. But once I could kind of extract that, in the future, when things happened that seemed a little bit more senseless, while still painful, it did kind of fit into my broader revised set of beliefs that, oh, I just have to be able to explain everything, sometimes bad things really do just happen, and it's not fair, and life isn't always fair in that way.
You know, many of us, I think, see things very black and white, you know. If we're, you know, the world is good or bad, you know, just the thing that brings us to this kind of introspection is pain and emotional struggle. You know, when we have to take a look at an issue that we're dealing with that does not fit into the black or white, and we have to begin to examine it. And I know for me, it was the most painful thing in my life that brought me to a sense of spiritual connection, not religious, but spiritual connection, which gave me a direction that comforted me and made me feel as if I had, you know, I had support. And so I would not have come to that otherwise, or I don't believe I would have come to that otherwise. So I guess we all find it through pain. Hopefully we find it through pain.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what we're seeing. One of my favorite spiritual teachers is Richard Rohr, and he talks about the two greatest teachers are great love and great suffering. And I just think that's so powerful. And I think there is a part of me, at least as human, I would love to have learned this through great love. I don't know if I would have. And I think there is a place too, like to be honest, is, and I love what you said, Randy, is like we can get through this. You know, you can see the grace and that you learned through that, for that horrible, those things you're talking about, those experiences. And I think that's often, like, I want that for myself too, but when I'm in the midst, like when I was in the midst of, like, I remember, like, crying on the floor, wailing, that, you know, ugly cry, guttural cry after losing Daryl's brother, I could never have imagined emerging from it. And I think that's the piece too, is that there is a time for everyone that's going through these very clarifying moments, these existential crises, in which we want to be honest, it's not easy. There is a period of time that is in the darkness where it's disorienting, it's painful, you don't think you'll ever get through it. And that's actually part of the process too. And so many of our stories, and I think it's, you know, even easy for people to project that on us, that, you know, we wrote this book and look how great it is and it turned out. But there are some kinds of intense suffering. You know, I think we have a little bit more hope now because we've sort of passed through that phase. But if we were to have written the book in the middle of the darkness, I don't think it would have had some of the same ideas as well, because it's all a part of the problem.
Right. And, you know, and I explained, commented to you that I read your book, The Courage to Suffer, A New Clinical Framework for Life's Greatest Crises. And I found it extremely valuable in not only personally, but in helping those who are trying to, my work is helping people recover from narcissistic abuse, which is irrational. There is no explanation. The person holds no responsibility for what happened to them. And it is the most helpless feeling in the world. And so going through your guide of how to deal with this, how to help people deal with this, is going to be so impactful in the work that I do.
Thank you.
So I really, really appreciate that. There was a quote at the beginning of chapter 2 where you said, where Barbara Brown Taylor from Learning to Walk in the Dark says, "I have learned things in the dark that I could never have learned in the light, things that have saved my life over and over again, so that there is really only one logical conclusion. I need darkness as much as I need light." I really, really like that. That just speaks to everything that we're talking about. So what does an encounter with darkness make us feel, disorients us, and reveals our vulnerability?
So, you know, this encounter with darkness, you know, like you said, it's disorienting. I think some of the things that it can do is it kind of brings these existential themes to the forefront. It kind of makes us encounter the reality of some of these givens of human existence. And when that happens, a lot of times what people will do is they want to avoid. And so they engage in what researchers call, what clinicians call, experiential avoidance. Right? And Americans are really good at this. We have Netflix, we have our phones, we have our work, exercise. We have lots of things that we can just throw ourselves into to either avoid the pain or numb the pain, push it away. But that's a problem when we're not willing to sit in that darkness, when we're not willing to name our pain and actually experience our pain. Ironically, it prolongs the pain. You know, it's a little bit of like an emotional procrastination strategy. You know, when the Netflix show is over, the pain is still going to be there. Avoidant coping, we all know, is one of the worst ways to cope. And so for so many, the darkness, symbolically, metaphorically, and maybe even literally, can be so terrifying that we're just kind of instinctually programmed to avoid it. But like you said, there's so much that can be found in the darkness. There's so much that can be revealed by remaining in the darkness, feeling and naming the pain. That it's worth overcoming that avoidance.
Yeah, and we hope to, part of the book, like you named, is to look at the value of the darkness You know, and I want to say something. Each of the quotes that we put in our each chapter were very significant to us, that were even works that we read along the way when we were searching and trying to find all these answers. And, you know, Barbara Brown Taylor, I could not speak highly enough of her work. And she talks about how we often have a, like, solar view of spirituality. The idea of spirituality is just in the light. So happiness, centering, calm, all these things. And she actually argues in her book, Learning to Walk in the Dark, is that we need lunar spirituality. So just like the phases of the moon, the phases of the darkness, we can actually find our grounding even when it's disorienting. And sometimes, you know, what we say in our book is sometimes it's like going back to the very basics of the things that bring you connection to other people and even to yourself. So, you know, I think the darkness in of itself is disorienting, and so, but it's also so valuable. And so I think there is a fear that actually is instinctual that happens when we're facing suffering. And I think what we're asking people is to use that fear, use that as information without judgment, so that you can actually glean some wisdom from that.
That's a good point, a good thing to say. How does this apply to most of the people that I work with? Most people who have suffered narcissistic abuse are suffering from complex PTSD. And there's so much involved in that. Would you relate that? Would you think that your approach works for those who have that complex trauma, have suffered this complex?
Yeah, absolutely, Randy. I mean, I think that those people that are suffering, right, I think that's what we're trying to say with our book is so much in the past has been like, you know, just look at the symptom, get the symptom gone, you're fine, discharge you. And things like chronic, complex PTSD are things that people live with for the rest of their lives on various intensities, right? And so it's actually a way, and what we actually argue towards the end of our book is we argue for authenticity, not in the sense of, how about this? We're arguing for authenticity in the sense of integration of that into your story. And so part of the people that you get to work with, that you're so privileged to work with, part of their story is emotional abuse, complex triggers, complex pain that will shape them for the rest of their lives. And when we can integrate that into the story of ourselves, we actually get to earn our power back, because then this is what's happened to me, this is where I'm at, and now where do I want to go from here? So it's very empowering. And yes, the integration happens because, yes, they did not want this to be part of their story. I do not want that to be a part of their story. I know you don't either. But it's this integration that happens when we're able to experience it, name it, accept it, and then we start to integrate it so that then we know how to go forward. That allows us to then find connection again with ourselves. So I think it's 100% applicable.
That's really, really great news. it's really good news, and I know a lot of people are excited about that, you know. And to my listeners, you know, you can contact Daryl and Sarah Van Tongeren, or you can contact me, because now I have the method. They gave me the method. But it's great, yeah. So you talk about overcoming suffering requires building meaning. And you define meaning as the subjective feeling that our experiences and life make sense, matter, and are purposeful. And then you talk about the three main components of meaning: coherence, significance, and purpose. Can you go through those three components and explain?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, as a researcher who studies meaning in life, a lot of times people get nervous that it's this really, you know, big, you know, topic. But and while it is, I think these three components just make a lot of intuitive sense. So,
and we want to clarify, too, that we're talking about the meaning in life rather than the meaning of life.
Right, not like the big capital M, you know, meaning, but just kind of how people make sense of finding meaning in their own lives, in their own ways. So the first component of meaning is what people call coherence. And so coherence is when things make sense. So Randy, part of what you were talking about was when people are trying to explain why something happened, if we can kind of make sense of something, then it feels meaningful. But things that are senseless often to us feel very meaningless. Like my brother dying and him leaving, you know, three kids, very young kids, that seemed very senseless.
Or like the people that you work with, the abuse that they endured, that is senseless. Like it absolutely is.
Right.
And so that's gonna really strain their meaning. That's gonna feel meaningless. They may feel a little bit less sure of their own meaning, and for good reason. It just doesn't make any sense. The second component is significance. And significance, people ask the question, do I matter? And so when someone feels as if they matter, mattering is what makes people feel significant. You feel like you're a person of worth. And so when people are suffering, they often don't feel like they matter. They feel insignificant. They feel worthless. I'm thinking about your abuse survivors. They may feel insignificant. They may be receiving direct messages that they're not worthwhile.
Yes.
That is so undercutting to their sense of meaning. And then the third component is purpose. And purpose, and you can think about this in lots of different ways, this kind of answers the question, like, why am I here? Like, what's my intention? What's my direction in life? And when people feel like they have an intention or they have a goal or they have a direction that they're headed, life can feel pretty purposeful and pretty meaningful. But suffering sometimes robs us of that. It kind of strips away our ability to move towards something intentional. And so when things don't make sense and people don't feel like they matter and they don't have a purpose, they can really get mired in a sense of meaninglessness, which can just further perpetuate this cycle of suffering. And so, you know, one of the suggestions we make is that building meaning then might be one of the surest ways to kind of break the cycle of suffering and to help people flourish in the midst of their suffering.
Yeah, so it's finding meaning. You know, even just start with starting with a question personally for all of us is, when you think about it, when you look at your life and you think about the times when you felt the most connected to yourself, to something greater than yourself, when are those times? You know, what makes your life filled with meaning? And I think that's the best place to start for all of us, right? Like, that's the place where we can each look and say, like, okay, we can do something with that, right? If we're integrating this suffering into our story, we're living authentically, we can ask ourselves, what are the times where we feel connected? We feel like our lives have meaning. And you know, for me, when I was in the midst of all of this, it was often, and it still is, when I'm in nature. Nature is something that gives my life a lot of meaning, a lot of connection, a sense to something greater. And so I found myself then seeking those places of nature as almost like a sanctuary for solitude, for connection. And I think you have to start there. And right, maybe that looks very simple, but it's very significant for all of us.
So directing it back to the pandemic and what we're going through, you know, we're all wondering what's going to happen when this is over. Is it going to be normal? Is there going to be a new normal? So that is definitely an episode of existential suffering, right?
Yeah. Okay. We have that conversation every night at dinner.
Yeah.
Is there going to be a new goal?
Yeah. Well, and it's that reality that, like, again, to sort of go back to what we said at the beginning, those we have a loss of control. We're afraid of being alone. Who am I in this? If I've lost a job, if I have not been able to do the hobby that I've enjoyed, and then the fear of the fact that we could die from this virus, right? So it's here, those existential questions for sure. And I think maybe what I'm seeing from obviously our work, our life, our life's work, I'm seeing what's happening on a broad scale to be a really, really reaction against those four fears. So people don't want to believe they're going to die, so they don't wear a mask in public. Or people want to have control, so they need to go get their hair dyed at the hairdresser the way that they used to be able to. And so it's this idea that if I can just get normal back, then everything's fine. But the truth is we've ignored all that has happened. So it's a version of circumventing the deep ask question. If we just stick on that, is it going to be normal? Is it going to be normal? Is it going to be normal? That's where we can sort of we get stuck when we're avoiding, why do we want it to be normal? What are we afraid of? Why are we avoiding the fact that this most likely has changed us forever?
Right.
This is the thing that I think about for people that have suffered. You go through something like this, the loss of a job, a massive change of your daily schedule, pretty drastically, pretty quickly. Even if you go back to work and everything's fine, everything goes back to the same, your inside psychological experience is forever changed. And so that's what we're talking about even in this book, is you can go back to quote-unquote normal, but the deep psyche of yourself is then affected by that. And that's not a bad thing. But we just avoid it, is what we do. It's somewhat of our human nature. We want to avoid the pain. You know, we always joke at dinner, like, would you rather, you know, be fit without having to exercise, or, you know, be rich without having to work? And we're always like, yeah, let's do that. Like, no one wants the pain or the hard work. Like, it's a part
exactly.
of humanity, I think.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, if for those who believe they had control over their life, this is going to be very devastating. Because the point is, I mean, if we look at this whole picture, I'm a big picture person because for me that gives things meaning.
Yeah.
You know, but if we look at this whole thing, we have to understand the point is we have no control. We have absolutely no control over our lives. And so I guess for some people, that is a really tough concept that they're dealing with. But can't look
right.
away from that. I mean, you can try, but
right.
when you're isolated and there's nothing to do, I mean, that is the most obvious thing to me about this. That it shows us all that no matter how much we try to plan and control, we absolutely cannot control the way our lives go. So is that a hard concept for many people?
Oh, yeah, it really is. So one of the, back in the 80s, Shirley Taylor, a world-famous psychologist who wrote extensively on coping, and she came up with this theory of cognitive adaptation. She said that our sense of control, she called it the illusion of control, is one of three positive illusions that humans have that are really important for kind of adaptive, healthy functioning. And so she argued, you know, it's kind of innate in our human nature to believe that we have control. And, you know, adversity, stress, suffering, things like this will reveal that illusion. Sure enough, over time, people will eventually go back to embracing that illusion of control again. You know, because on the one hand, it's like, well, I need to believe that something that I do in this world is making a difference. Otherwise, I could get pretty depressed pretty quick. But on the other hand, believing that I can control things that are outside my control is actually just another recipe for more heartache, because I can't control other people. I can't control other people's reactions. I can't control the world. I can't control invisible viruses that might again sweep through and affect us on a global scale. So I think for a lot of people, they don't like to believe that. They don't like to think that they don't have control. They like to think if they work hard enough or outsmart it, they can master the situation. So it's tough. So if any of you are listening and you're like, I don't want to believe that, you're not alone. Not a lot of people want to believe that. They want to accept that control is an illusion.
And I think for me, like another word, and this is what I'll do for some of my clients that I work with, is another name for like the fear of groundlessness, which is the loss of control, the existential fear of loss of control is existential freedom. And so something that's really fascinating is on the other side of the same coin that we want control is we also want freedom. And so in some ways I found in my own personal life that when I wanted control the most is when I'm the least happy or the least connected, the least centered. And the times when I'm okay with freedom, okay with accepting that there's a lot of things out of my control, or when I'm the most centered. And so, really pushing in a little bit to say, again, exploring where that fear and that desire to control things come from, rather than, trying to control things. There's been, sure, when I was in the midst of existential, fears with Daryl's health, I would try to control, did you drink enough water? Did you exercise? Did you do these things? And like, yes, those things make a difference. But at the same time, I found myself just going crazy and feeling like I couldn't even breathe,
Right.
And then there's the other side of the freedom of just being like, we're going to try our best and see what happens. I think that there's
right.
some space I get to that.
Right. So, people say to me sometimes, well, if I can't control it, why? What would motivate me? Why would I even do anything? And what do I want to say? Things. It's more about influence than it is control. So we can influence the path of our life. We can influence the future. We can't control it, but we can do things that influence it. So there's a difference between influence and control, right?
Yeah, that's... In our book, we talk a little bit about understanding the things you can affect and the things that are outside of your control. So I like that.
I like the word of influence. That's great, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the idea of, I think that the other piece is, in some ways, I think when we can let go of the need to control it, we can also then let are bad or things that are scary or trauma or narcissistic. We encounter narcissistic people randomly and we don't have control over that. Then in some ways that sets us free from self.
Right. So, yeah, so we can, it doesn't mean that we have to let go of a plan or, an idea or a project or whatever, or a goal. It's not about letting go of the goal. It's about understanding that we can work towards that. But then basically we have to just understand that life is going to take us in different directions. So we've got to be prepared for that and open-minded. So this is all very good. It's a good way to think. But it's a challenge for many people to get to that point. Let's see. There was something I wanted to say. Okay. I wanted to talk about this surreal kind of world that we're living in, where we go out and everybody's wearing masks and people treat you like you're a leper. They step back and away from you. this is just so hard for us to wrap our heads around, right?
Yeah.
Right, absolutely. Again, and it's very isolating. Humans are just naturally social, right? We're designed to be in social relationships. And so when people are kind of moving the other way, when we have to be far away from each other, that's tough. That just cuts across how we're designed to be. Sarah and I try to take a walk most nights, and we do a really good job of avoiding other people and darting from one side of the sidewalk to another. And, you know, but it's so funny because when we see another human out, I have this instinctual desire. I've never met them before, just to come across the street to wave and say, hi, you know, your dog looks great. Because I'm just kind of desperate for that connection that I'm not always getting with my Zoom meetings or, you know,
right,
FaceTime
exactly.
calls.
Right.
And so, yeah,
I mean, I'm someone that likes to, I like to smile at people. I smile at everybody.
Yeah.
And I'm walking through the store and I'm smiling and I'm thinking, nobody can see that. Maybe they can see my eyes, the expression in my eyes, maybe, but they're not seeing me smile at them. And it's weird because that just, I can't connect.
Right. Right. We're taking away a bit of the way that we show our humanity to other people.
Well, a bit of way that brings us meaning. Right, a bit of way that it's human connection, nature, those are the things that bring meaning personally. And so it has been, this has also been a challenge, I think, to all of us, is not only it's engaged our existential fears, but it's also engaged the things that bring us meaning, right? And that, I mean, something that brings me a lot of meaning is I compete in triathlons. And so all of the triathlons this summer have been canceled. And so, like, I find myself wanting to train, and I can't really train for anything right now. And so, you know, there's that identity spread, right? And then the thing that brings me meaning. So it is, we're all sort of in the midst of all of this. So realizing, I think, the other piece is this consciousness of we are in the midst of a collective trauma. We are in the midst of a collective experience. And so that is going to erode meaning. That is going to challenge our existential fears. And I think sometimes it's just the education around that. Say, like, when we come out home from the grocery store and we're exhausted more than normal, there's a reason. You know, we're not crazy. That's a human experience. It's challenged our existential fear. It's challenged our meaning, which is a way we can cope with our existential fear. So, of course, we're exhausted. So, you know, that can also help remove some of that stigma, too, that we carry with ourselves.
I wonder how many people are going to develop agoraphobia, you know, from being home.
I would say the same thing.
Yeah.
Agoraphobia,
I know, it's
and OCD. Right now,
right.
Those are very adaptive responses. And we need those in some ways. Like, that's the protective way of acting right now. And, you know, as you and I both know, it happens when we are, it's an adaptive coping skill now. But once this is behind us, it hopefully will no longer be adaptive, and we need to then, we'll have to work to overcome those skills that we just worked so hard to learn right now. And so, yeah, I do wonder that, Randy, myself. we were walking and we're like, okay, there's another human across the street. And then, like, normally we're, like, petting their dog and talking to them. And
yes, it's pretty bizarre. So if you were to give us, you know, 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, 3, 4 step for how to go through this pandemic in a healthy-minded way, what would you say?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we suggest is thinking about finding meaning. And you think about your head, your heart, your hands. And so all of these ways are ways of making connection. Because, like you really pointed out, and I thought it was so beautiful, you were saying that you find meaning by connecting to something bigger than yourself. And I think most people are just like you. And so with the head, for a lot of people, that's a sense of spirituality and or religion. It's a way of connecting with this larger story that's bigger than you. The heart is connecting with other people. It's relationships. When we ask people, you know, what's the biggest source of meaning in life, most people will say it's relationships. And so, well, right now that's kind of a strange and odd process for many people. So you can still try to connect with people virtually or from a distance.
Or wave to people.
Wave to people. That's going to be another way that you can find meaning. And then with the hands, to the degree that you can help other people. So we talk about virtues in our book, and one of the ones we talk about is the sense of vulnerable compassion. So people who have experienced suffering do have a deep sense of vulnerability, and they know what that pain feels like, and hopefully they can turn that into a sense of compassion for other people who are also suffering. And so, you know, kind of thinking broadly about how can I connect with the spiritual, with the divine, with my head, with other people, with my heart, and kind of think about others and serving others, acting virtuously, kind of think about my hands. those would be kind of three broader ways of finding meaning.
Yeah, and I think those things that we can find connection with, right? I was going to say we could, you know, practice acceptance, right? We can practice right now very concretely. This is where we are. And so this pandemic that, like sort of what Sarah was saying, we have to then tailor our head, heart, and hands towards the act of being in this pandemic. So it's one, it's practicing acceptance. Two, it's using fear as information. So when we are afraid and we're in the grocery store and we're heightened sense, being aware of that and saying, like, oh, what is this trying to tell me? This is trying to tell me that this is weird. This is trying to tell me that this isn't normal. This isn't how I used to connect with people. And then we use a source of connection. So finding connection in ourselves with the divine or spiritual, in nature and with others. And so doing that in a way that is the acceptance of what is right now. So, of course, it may not look like how it was even 7 weeks ago, but it can look like what it is now. And so not shying away from that is really, really
right.
important.
I think that's great,
actually,
yeah.
Yeah, it can help us, right? It can help us where we're at now.
Right, to connect with what you're actually feeling rather than just allowing the feeling to take you over, to actually connect with it. And, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so that's a good one. Anything else that we can do to keep ourselves from going crazy?
I'm talking to myself as much as I'm talking to anybody else. My routine, I kind of enjoy routines. And routines kind of help us structure our day. They kind of help us.
We get feel in control.
Yeah, they kind of give us a little bit of a sense of meaning. So sometimes just making sure that you have a routine, even if it's a new routine. So Sarah and I, this is very unusual for us, but we're both able to work at home, so now we can have lunch together each day, which was something we couldn't do pre-pandemic because we were both at our jobs. And so we're able to have this little lunch routine. And so I actually look forward to that in the morning. And then we try to take a walk in the evening. And so we've kind of instilled a few little routines that can give us things to look forward to and provide a little bit of structure for an otherwise kind of structureless day that can feel a little bit like it's slipping away. So routines,
right.
I think, would be helpful for many of us.
Yeah, and I just say a lot of self-compassion. I think that's what we need right now. Some people are responding very productively and have done all these amazing projects and they've spread and done all these painting jobs. And then there are some people like me that I just need to take a nap. That's okay. And so just realizing that right now, I would encourage people to listen to themselves, listen to what they're feeling, listen to what, and then see if you can offer yourself something from that, right, rather than often we shame ourselves, we should be that way, we should, you know, I always say we should all over ourselves. Like
we should all over ourselves.
Right, like, but just listening to yourself, I think that's the other piece. And again, if we use our fear, our feelings as information, if you're feeling disconnected and isolated, reach out to people. And yes, it may not be person to person, but I will say this, Zoom or Skype is better, or FaceTime is better than nothing. And so if you're feeling isolated, reach out to people. That's really important things. And if, you know, if for people that are listening that are feeling like what they're doing isn't working out, don't be afraid to reach out to therapists. I think that's the other piece is I think therapists can offer such a world of support to so many people as well.
Right. So if we're, you know, some people are telling me, I just feel so unmotivated. I'm sitting on the couch all day. I'm watching a lot of, you know, Netflix, which I'm doing at night, but I'm not during the day. But anyway, they're like, and I can't get motivated. I don't want to exercise. I don't want to walk. I just, like, I'm like, bleh. So
yeah.
How do we motivate ourselves? I guess small steps at a time, right? Little things.
Yeah, I think small steps and finding that thing that provides that little spark of meaning. You know, if that's maybe a new hobby.
Well, I'm just going to say even more than that can vary. Yeah, that can vary as in cases right there. But I was going to say, like, doing something as simple as can you sit outside? Can you try to change that scenery as, like, just something small? Again, I will say, what brings in life meaning? Not, like, done, like, previously, because, again, I would say travel and been hiking and all my favorite spots, which now is overrun and I can't do anymore. So, for me, it's like, okay, nature. nature is used to bring it to me. So instead of eating inside, I'm actually going to start eating outside today. And just something simple as that, like, can help just give the spark enough.
Right.
That's right. Because I mean, to me, that sounds like hopelessness is what that feels like. That's what it sounds like to me. It feels hopeless. And so just changing the scenery just a little can be give us the boost we need.
Okay, that's really a good idea. And, I don't know, we have just about a minute or so left. Did you have a message or anything else that you wanted to share? And also tell us if you have a website and how we can get your book.
Yeah, so I have a website at darylvantongren.com.
And my website is darylvantongren.com. And then you can follow me on Instagram at the Existential Therapist.
And then you can find our books on Amazon or our publisher's website, which is Templeton Press, called The Courage to Suffer.
And also anywhere books are sold. I know that a lot of small businesses are suffering right now. And so selling and asking, calling your local bookstore and asking them to secure a copy, they can do that as well.
Okay, good,
yeah,
good.
So thank you for having us, Brandy. We really, really appreciate it so much.
Yeah, I really appreciate you and the work that you're doing. And you know, I love learning about this stuff and applying it. So your book's great. For those of us who are listening and really can relate to this, pick up a copy of The Courage to Suffer and take a look at the process. Anyway, it's been great. It's been wonderful. Have a wonderful day having lunch, I guess. Lunch will be the most exciting thing you're going to do next. So enjoy your lunch. I'm going to have lunch too, you know. But anyway,
thanks,
have a wonderful, wonderful day. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So we are out of time, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's show. Visit randyfine.com, RANDIFINE.com, and be sure to sign up to receive updates on the latest blog posts, events, and upcoming shows. Thank you for listening.